Zechariah. We have been looking together at, we saw it's divided up, Zechariah, second last book in the Old Testament, divided up in 6, 2, and 6. First six chapters dealing with prophetic statements about what God's going to do in blessing Israel in the future. The last six chapters dealing with the same thing again in a different style. And then chapter 7 and 8, a prophetic theme, but more specifically related to some specific issues being dealt with Israel at that time. We come back now to chapter 9. We saw chapter 9 dealt with God predicting in advance the coming of Alexander the Great. But the reason wasn't to give us the account of Alexander the Great. That's not the purpose of it, although he did that. It was basically, again, to show that God is always there in behalf of his people. And all of those years, they waited and waited and waited upon God to respond. And now God shows them, in fact, in anticipation that he's going to do it. And so in chapter 9, verses 1 through 8, he is dealing with what he is going to do with the enemies of Israel. It's basically here, Tyre and Sidon, and then, of course, the four of the five Philistine cities, the fifth one, Gath, already having been destroyed before that time. That leads, though, from that into the anticipation in verse 9 of the greatest king of all, the Lord Jesus Christ, coming. And that we find in verse 9 and verse 10. Verse 9 is reflecting his first coming, and verse 10 his second coming. And then what happens after that, he then gives us some more prophetic statements about what God is going to do just before the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ, and yet at the same time anticipating what God's going to do in the future when he comes back to establish his kingdom in the land. And what a great statement we concludes on in verse 16 of chapter 9. The Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they are as stones of a crown sparkling in his land. What comeliness and beauty will be theirs. Grain will make the young men flourish and new wine the virgins. Just an incredible statement of what God is going to do. We come into chapter 10 and just some brief statements this evening as we look through this passage. If you have the outline, we'll be following it. First of all, it's interesting because in reality, is one of these places where chapter breaks shouldn't be here, but it is, so you just take it. But this is one of those cases where verse 1 finishes up chapter 9, verse 17, and yet it transitions into chapter 10. The whole issue of all that lies behind in chapter 9 of what God will do. Let me just take you back to the statement in verse 15 of chapter 9. The Lord of hosts will defend them. They will devour and trample on the sling stones. They're going to throw these stones at them, and they're going to walk along stepping on them because, you know, just sort of in their face kind of stuff, because the stones aren't going to hurt them. They're not going to affect them. The Lord God will blow the trumpet. We will march in the storm winds of the south. The Lord of hosts will defend them. This whole thing, the issue is God's defend. They will drink, they'll be boisterous as with wine, they'll be filled with it like a sacrificial basin, drenched like the corners of the altar. What we saw here is the victory that would be theirs, and the Lord their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people. As you look at this, all of these things are things that God does. God does them. The reminder for us, we just stop for a while, is you understand every blessing we have comes from God. Every blessing we have comes from God. And that's what he's reminding them here. And then, so therefore, in verse 1 of chapter 10, he's just summing up the latter part of verse 19. He says, you know, if you want rain, ask the Lord for the rain. He is the one who makes the storm clouds. He will give the showers of rain. He will give vegetation in the field to each man. You know, the farmer understands, whether he believes in God or not, he believes in God or fate, because the farmer, more than anybody else, is dependent upon God. He is. He just plain is going to go out there, and he's going to do the work in the field. He's going to prepare the field, and it's up to the Lord to make the difference. It just is. What he's talking about here in the spring rain is that there are the two rains. In the Old Testament, you have the early rains and the latter rains. The difference between the two, the early rains are horrendously harsh rains. And the reason for that is, you've gone for months without rain. I mean, it's not like here, here we have the same thing, you know, in a sense, but not as drastic as other nations. In other parts of the world, you have just dry spell in there with no rain at all. We used to be able to have a bucket a day for each person in the family, and that was to flush the toilet with, and that was to wash with, and that was whatever else you wanted to do. You had a bucket of water a day because you couldn't get it from the well. The well was dry. We'd get in trucks, and we would drive miles to find any water to put in some container to bring back because it just wasn't water. And so after all of this time, you know that this is the time of the year the rain's going to come. So what they do is go out there on the very hard ground, and they dig the ground up, and this is all by hand. They didn't use horses or whatever. They just took these hand hoes, and they, in this very hard ground, they dig these mounds. And then what they do in the harvest, because you don't go down to the store to buy seed, they'd save the seed from the, you know, they take the year before, they take a portion of it for planting, a portion of it they use for trading and bartering for something else, and a portion of it they use for eating. The portion that was for planting they had here, and so it was all they had. It wasn't like they could go buy some more. They would take this and they would put it in the ground, trusting that rain would come. Well, when the rain came, what happened, or if the rain did come, and usually it did, it would be a harsh rain because it would have to break, it would have to melt into this very hard ground. It would start the plant growing. Well, the plant would grow, and it'd be months later, and the plant now is up to a point where it's getting ready for harvest. And then what you need is the light rains. I mean, you don't want the harsh rains again. And the real light rains come, and what they do is they just prepare the crop for harvest. The problem with it is sometimes the early rains don't come. And the seed is in the ground, and it does germinate, and nothing happens to it, and you're without. I remember when the desert was going south, the Sahara was, and a man in Niger, a Muslim, he said on CBS News, I can still see it, he says, I put my last seed in the ground, now it's up to Allah. Well, it didn't rain, and Allah didn't come through for him. It is interesting because the first rain can come. But the other thing is you can get the crop up and right ready to go, and then all of a sudden a harsh rain comes. I think Bill's, your wedding, is probably one of the most, in this side of the ocean, one of the most remarkable times I've watched, because it was the best wheat harvest they had had for years in Colorado. And the crop was just as exciting to them. They look at this crop, and it was incredible. The night of the practice, Friday night, was it? Friday night, they came into the place, the practice, we'd had a dinner, we'd had practice, and they said, you better get home in a hurry unless you plan to spend the night here. And it was a hailstorm coming through. I remember as I was driving, I could hardly see the road, and I'm saying to Scott, I said, pray, but I said, understand, we're just praying that God's will be done, but if it be God's will, that he stops his hail before it gets here. And the next day we found out it stopped 10 miles away. But you know, it's interesting because it destroyed, even the fact that it didn't destroy those crops, it did take away so much of what they anticipated harvesting because it did mess up the crop very badly, and in some cases destroyed it. You look at all of this, you see the farmer is totally dependent upon God. I mean, he just is. For us, you see, we're so far removed from that because we just buy it from the store, right? It just costs a little bit more. But you know what? We're in the same boat that they are. It's just that we don't recognize it as clearly. Isn't it right? And part of this is the reminder, he says to them, you know, ask from God. He's the one who gives the rain. He does it. Now the trouble with them is, verse 2, the teraphim. See, what they were looking at, and notice the teraphim and diviners, two things he speaks of, the teraphim. You know the teraphim. They were, they were the ones that, remember Jacob's wife, right? Huh? And his uncle, his uncle became his father-in-law, right? Chases him, right? Because he says, someone has taken the household gods. That's what these teraphim were. There's just no way in America we understand this, okay? But I've even watched Africans come to faith in Christ, and some of them even elders in the church. One of the men, who was one of my students, went out to preach in a place, and he came back, he says, I can't believe it. He says, I go to an elder's house for dinner, and over every doorway in the house is a household god. You see, we're willing to accept God, but we're not willing to let go of these things because there's some safety in that. I'll share with you. We had driver's ants come through. Driver's ants eat everything in the way. They just do. What you do is you just move out for the night. They clean your house out. They, like you wouldn't believe they clean the house out. The only thing I did was when we went out, because they do, in fact, I had chickens. And I went down and put fresh ashes around the chicken pen, because they'll go through and all you have left is bones the next morning. They just take anything that's there. It doesn't matter what it is. So put these, put these ashes, fresh ashes, they won't go through. And then we went and slept somewhere else for the night, and they just cleaned the house for us. You have no cockroaches the next day, you have nothing. So we came back. So we went out and we're taking fresh ash to put around our house in case they came back again. And this African comes to me. Listen, his name was Joel James. Jethro John. That's what his name was. Jethro John. You know what that is? You know, when you have Christian names like that, your last name is your father's first name, okay? Scott would be Scott Donald, and Donald would be his last name, and then his son would be whatever that would be, you know, James Scott or something, right? So it goes on like that, and your father's, and you only get these Christian names when you become a Christian, right? These biblical names when you've been baptized. When you get baptized, you get given a biblical name. Which tells you that his father was baptized and he was baptized. We're talking about second generation believer. He says, you don't need those ashes around your house. There's a guy you go to in town, he gives you the stuff, and you just bury it by the front door, see, and they'll never come by your house. See, these guys, I don't care, even second-generation believers cannot let go of what the witch doctors provide, okay? Here the teraphim, you're looking for them, the diviners. The diviners, it comes from the Hebrew word, is to cut. Because they would cut the liver, and by that, you know, of an animal, they'd be able to tell, you know, what you're going to happen. They divine stuff, you know. So what happens? He says, you guys, you're looking at the teraphim. You're looking at diviners. The teraphim speak iniquity or sin. The diviners speak lie, have lying visions. They tell false dreams. They comfort in vain. You guys, the problem is, when God's there to look to, you don't look to God. I just say, you know what? We are not so far removed from this. Are we? He is the provider of everything. You know, all of a sudden we get into a mess, and what we do, we call our banker, huh? Or we call anybody before we call. And after everybody else has messed up on us, then we go to God and say, God, we got a problem, see? It is almost like with a credit card business, see? We use those things, right, until we get right down. And then you see, when we're really stretched out and nobody else is going to take us anymore, we say, God, we got a problem. No, we had a problem before it ever started, see? You understand that? And the trouble is we go to God after everybody else. It bothers God. I got to tell you, it does. But you see, you look at this business here. God says, why don't you come to me? I provide the rain. You go to everybody else, but you don't come to me. So that was the problem. Well, because of this, okay, notice what happens. Because of this, there is four statements. My people wander like sheep. Do you know what's interesting with this, by the way? When I read this thing, it sounds like this is something that, they can't help or something like this. Let me tell you what it is. It's very, very interesting, because the term that is used here is the idea of somebody's traveling somewhere and they pull up the stakes. They pull up the stakes. It's like you say, you know what, it's time to move, and you're living in a tent, right? So let's pull up the stakes, let's pack up the tent, let's go somewhere else. Remember the trip we made? We had the tent in the back, and every night we set it up, every morning we take it down. That's what this was. See, they're just moving constantly. And what's happened is, this isn't as if somebody led them astray. They are wandering. They're just flat picking up their tent and moving away from God. My people are wandering like sheep. They're pulling up their stakes. They're folding up their tent. They're deliberately marching away from God. Deliberately marching away from God. This is willful. The Authorized Version puts it interesting. Therefore, the people went their way as a flock. That's exactly what it is. It isn't like somebody led them astray. They went astray. So anyhow, these people went astray. Notice about why. It goes in this context. The people went astray. Where we are. Okay, wandered like sheep. They're afflicted. Now this is not their doing. Someone else is doing this to them. And so, and by the way, it is an imperfect tense. For those of you about Hebrew, you know what it means? It is a continuous thing. It's not like this just happened once, okay? This just, bang, they were afflicted. Israel is being afflicted. Israel will be being afflicted. It is not just a singular occurrence. This is a way of life that is leading up to the time when the Messiah will come, which is defined in this passage. So my people, they wander like sheep. They are today, don't they? Huh? They're pulling up their tents and they're moving. They're not staking their stance with God. They keep moving away. They're being afflicted. They are. It's a continuous thing with Israel. By the way, continue to pray for the peace of Israel. You see, with the funeral taking place tomorrow, that you know, there's a big part of the peace situation there where God's in control, but pray for Israel. Because, you know, why are they doing this? Because there is no shepherd. This is the age-old issue. And by the way, shepherds, we're talking about the three shepherds. Go to the next chapter, you can find it. See, God says in the next chapter, he's talking about the shepherds that are going to be there. And it is interesting because in the next chapter he's talking about the shepherds, and he talks about cutting off the three shepherds, and notice. And he comments, he's going to talk about shepherds in the next chapter very strongly. In verse 4, he's going to say, pastor the shepherd, the flock, doomed to slaughter. And blessed be the Lord, for I am rich. Their own shepherds have no pity for them, verse 5. And because of this, God becomes bothered. In verse 8, he says, I annihilated three shepherds in 1 month. In chapter 11, verse 8, I annihilated three shepherds. What does he mean by three shepherds? In the prophets, the priests, and the kings. God says, I get rid of all of them. The prophets aren't leading people in a godly fashion. The priests aren't leading them in a godly fashion. The kings for sure aren't leading them in a godly fashion. And you know what's beautiful in the next chapter? Well, look at it. He said, I cut off all the shepherds. I want to become your shepherd. And they cut him off. Amazing. Anyhow, enough of that. We're back here. The shepherds are, there was no godly leader for Israel. Whether from the priest or the prophet or the king, there was no godly leader. Because of this, my anger is kindled against the shepherds. Now, this isn't the shepherds of Israel, by the way, because there was no shepherd in Israel. There was none. My anger is kindled against the shepherds. I will punish the male goats, for the Lord of hosts has visited his flock. The house of Judah will make them like his majestic horse in battle. So let's go to this. They wander like sheep. They're afflicted. God's anger is kindled against those who are afflicting them. And then what happens is God is going to repatriate Israel. And by the way, look at the latter part of verse 3. I will make them like his majestic horse in battle. Do you know what? Israel is going to be like God's majestic horse in battle. He is going to, you know, you can say, I don't like the figure, but he is a beautiful figure if you think about it. He's going to ride them to victory. He is. They are going to be the instrument of the victory. And they will be like a horse of majesty. Israel is going to be repatriated in an incredible way, and God's going to do this to them. So that's what he says here. Now notice what happens. In this context then, he says, now the solution to the problem. Notice where the solution comes. And here's where it gives it in verse 4. From them. Now, by the way, from them will come the cornerstone. From them the tent peg. From them the bow of battle. The cornerstone. Peter talks about this cornerstone. You know why the cornerstone? Because. I don't know how to illustrate this. If you have. Here we go. See if I can. This is open. I think it must open. There's the corner of the house. See, what happens is you put a stone on this corner, and the reason why this is because this cornerstone is more important than anything else along here, in a sense. Because you see, if in fact you have it all strong here, but nothing's here, these walls, one of them is going to sag, and if it starts to sag, you're going to hit an incredible crack in a wall. I know that because my father and others like them were not trained in the trade of building. My father built 16 mission stations in one country alone, and he wasn't a builder, okay? You learn a lesson because these guys get out there and they build these things. They think this is great. We got this wall up here. And you go to bed in some of these houses and you can see right through because there's a hole, a huge hole. Because they're just coming apart because of what? There's no solid cornerstone. The beautiful truth is that Christ is proclaimed in 1 Peter chapter 2 as the cornerstone. He's the one who holds together the two walls. He's the one that brings the unity. Why does Israel need a cornerstone? Not only don't they have unity with the nations of the world, they can't even get along with each other. And the whole point, your northern southern kingdom, standing there is a statement, and he says, in fact, one of his biggest statements, go back to chapter 9. I will cut off, verse 10, I'll cut off the chariot from Ephraim. I'll cut off the horse from Jerusalem. You see, Jerusalem's down in Judah, the southern kingdom. Ephraim's the northern kingdom. God says, I'm going to unite them because I am the cornerstone. Notice something else. See, this is the Messiah. From them will come the tent peg. Out of Israel comes the cornerstone. Out of Israel comes the tent peg. Now, you know, when you think about this, the most natural thing is to think that the tent peg here is what gives stability, okay? What's the cornerstone does? It gives stability because it's the tent peg is what holds the tent down so that it's not going to go away in a big storm. Maybe. Don't think that is the only picture here, if it is even the picture here. Others suggest, and I take you back to, go to Isaiah with me just a moment, because I want to tell you what happened. Go to Isaiah chapter 22, just for a moment. I want you to see a picture which, because we don't understand tents. Most of us, we just go camping in them and it's not like they used to be. Chapter 22. Isaiah chapter 22, and we could do all the chapter from 5 on, we're not going to do that. You know that's going to happen. But it's interesting because there is going to come one. And it's interesting because, by the way, in Revelation, this chapter is alluded to as a reference to the Lord Jesus Christ fulfilling this, okay? And it's in verse 22 especially. Notice, let's start with verse 22. We could do the whole thing, but let's just start 22. That I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens... 22:22. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. This is applied to Christ, okay? And I will drive him like a peg in a firm place. And it will become a throne of glory to his father's house. Now just wait. And they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house. Offspring and issue, all the least. Okay, let me tell you what. In the tents of those days, or in the dwelling places, but a lot of them lived in tents, as you know Abram did, right? And they had the tent pole. And what they would do in this wall of this thing, or in this tent pole, they would put a peg in there. And how you did it, if you had nice things, you hung the nice things around the house. You took your nice things, your things that were special, and you hung them around the place because it was a tent. It wasn't walls like this you could hang them on, right? And so you put this tent peg in a firm place and you hang stuff on it, okay? He's going to be a tent peg. And notice what we're going to hang on him. This is the tent peg in the tent. It's the peg that they put in a firm place in the tent where it's not going to go away and everybody walking will see it. And look what they're going to hang on this tent peg. He will become, verse 23, a throne of glory to his father's house. And notice, verse 24, they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house. Offspring and issue, all the least from bowls and jars and so forth. In that day, the peg driven a firm place will give way. It will even break off and fall in the land and so forth. You know what? That peg. It is interesting because the pegs that they had, even the people of Israel that were pegs, in a firm place, they're going to fall apart. There is a Messiah coming who's going to be a peg in a firm place. And I got to tell you, all the glory of Israel and all the glory of the house of David and all the glory of God is going to hang on him. That's the beauty of this. It's not just holding something firm. He's going to bear the glory. Fact of the matter is, go with me back to Zechariah and you can get the feeling again. Go with me back to chapter 6. We looked at chapter 6. Notice this in verse 13. This is about the branch in verse 12. This says, behold, a man whose name is Branch. He will branch out from where he is. And he will build the temple of the Lord. Yet is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he will also bear the honor and sit and rule. See, he will bear the honor. That's the idea. You know what? He's going to be a tent peg in a firm place, and all the glory of Israel and all the glory of the house of David and all the glory of God is going to hang on him. That's an amazing story. The picture is incredible. Go back with me. We're back in chapter 10 again. You see, where the answer comes is from the Messiah, the cornerstone, the tent peg, the bow of battle. Yep. Well, let me just show you what's going to happen quickly because we're going to draw this to conclusion, but I just want to show you what happens when the Messiah comes, see? He is the answer. You can go to your teraphim, it's not going to come from there. You can go to your diviners, it won't come from there. You go to Messiah, it will come. He is the cornerstone. He holds the pieces together. He is the tent peg. He bears the glory of God. He is the bow of battle. And notice what happens in this bow of battle. They, Israel, will be as mighty men. They're going to be not like they've ever been before. They will tread down the enemy in the mire of the streets in battle. They will fight, for the Lord will be with them, and the riders and horses will be put to shame. I will strengthen the house of Judah. I shall save the house of Joseph. House of Joseph? Tell me about house of Joseph. Who are Joseph's two sons? Who are Joseph's? Manasseh and Ephraim, right? The northern kingdom, Ephraim, and so therefore called Joseph. He, notice what happens. Judah and Joseph. I will strengthen the house of Judah. I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back. Why? Because I've had compassion on them. They will be as though I had not rejected them. For I am the Lord their God, and I will answer them. And Ephraim will be like a mighty man. And their heart will be glad as if from wine. Indeed, their children will see it and be glad. Their heart will rejoice in the Lord. Oh, that's not all. Look at this last part in verse 8 to 12. They're going to triumph over their enemies, and then be fully restored as a nation. Notice what happened. I will whistle for them. Not like you whistle for a dog. You know what? It's interesting because in other contexts, you have the shepherd who is on his whistle that they would have and start to do the whistle and the sheep would follow. I'm going to blow the whistle and they're going to come. See, notice what happens. I will whistle for the gather them together. I have redeemed them. They will be as numerous as they were before. When I scatter them among the peoples, they will remember me in far countries, and they will, with their children, will live and come back. I'll bring them back from the land of Egypt. I'll gather them from Assyria. I'll bring them back in the land of Gilead and Lebanon until no room can be found for them. You know what? The Jews are coming home. You can say they're coming home now. They're going to come home in the future like they have never come home before. There will, you see, even in the early part of this, the earlier visions, there are going to be so many people in Jerusalem. You can't put a wall around it. There are going to be so many people. They just show how big it's going to be. They're just going to be there. And notice what's going to happen. He will pass through the sea of distress, verse 11, and strike the waves of the sea. You know, when did he do this before? Notice, so that all the depths of the Nile will dry up. You know what? He dried up the Red Sea once, didn't he? He dried up the Jordan once, right? Why the Nile? The Nile has so much water. You know what? The Nile overflows its bank twice a year, so they have two different harvests, okay? That's how plentiful the water is, okay? He's going to dry up the Nile. What, you know, all he's trying to say, it isn't even about the water, see, because they can fly in airplanes anyhow, right? He's going to say, you know what? Nothing is going to stop them from coming back to Israel again. Whatever is in the way is going to be taken out of the way. I'll dry up anything. I dried up water before, I'll dry it up again. They're coming back home. And I'll tell you what, the pride of Assyria will be brought down. The scepter of Egypt will depart. And I will strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. You know what? The last part of chapter 10 is one of the most triumphant passages anywhere with regard to Israel's future. But let me tell you something. It is put there. It is put there at a pinnacle, if you will. Because the next chapter is going to describe the fact that when the shepherd came to his people the first time, they cut him off. It is a devastating thing because this hasn't happened to Israel for just nothing, God says. And God says, I'm coming back again. But he sets this high point, and then he's going to go, in a sense, to the lowest point. He's going to go to the cutting off of the Messiah in chapter 11. We'll look at it next week. But anyhow, you know, this is a tremendous thing. It's going to happen. And it's probably not that far away. Is it? You can say, well, it's happening now. Not like it's going to happen. Not like it's going to happen. God is going to come back again. Israel is going to be. And I'll tell you what, let the UN do what it wants. Let the threats of anybody, including the United States, be what it wants. You see, you guys have to, or else. You know what? In that day, it's not going to matter. And all the nations of the earth are going to gather against Israel in that day. They're going to come against Israel. But I got to tell you what, when the Lord is with them, they win. And I got, you know, let's come back to us before we go just to Israel. You know what? I don't care how big the enemy is, and I don't care how big, you see, all the nations of the world are going to gather against Israel. It says that in Zechariah 14, right? If the Lord is with them, even if all the nations of the world are against them, what? They're going to win. Right? You listen, if God what? If God be for us, who can be against us? We look at the obstacles. We go running to the tariff and we go running to the divider instead of going back to the provider of the rain. If God is for us, you know what? It doesn't matter how many people team up against us. We'll win. Huh? We've got to. Absolutely have to. You know why? That's why there can never be a bad day in your life. I'm serious. Believe me, right? Huh? Every day is awesome. Huh? Every day is awesome because you never walk alone. Amazing truth. Okay, enough of that, but you know what? Amazing passage, incredible passage. Yep. All right. Oh, I'm excited about God, period. You know what? I said it because some guy in chapel talked about only God is awesome. So someone says, how is it? I said, it's awesome. They said, you didn't listen to chapel. I said, I did. I said, God is awesome, and he controls every day, so every day is awesome, right? It has to be. Has to be. Huh? Either that or, you know what? This doesn't mean anything. Anyhow, whatever. The pinnacle. And we will go to a bit of depression next week, but it's all right because the great part is he's coming back again. And you know what? Even though they rejected the shepherd the first time, he's going to come back and shepherd them anyhow. All right.